Welcome to A Longer Table Podcast, a space where curiosity and proximity will challenge everything you thought you knew. I'm your host, Amanda Carpenter, inviting you to pull up a seat. You just might leave thinking, maybe we're not so different. Long gone are my days of shopping at Forever 21. Now that I know better, I try to do better. I try to shop ethically and avoid contributing to the world of fast fashion. And I'd rather purchase fewer high-quality pieces that will last instead of buying cheap, low-quality clothes that wear out after a few washes. This is just one reason I love Able. Able's high-quality leather, handmade jewelry, apparel, denim, and shoes aren't just investment pieces for your wardrobe. They're an investment in women around the world. Able takes their responsibility to their customers, the planet, and their social impact very seriously. So if, like me, you want insanely cute, lasting staples hanging up in your closet, and you want to support a mission that's greater than yourself, give Able a visit at ableclothing.com. Join myself and Able in moving fashion forward. Use code ALONGERTABLE15 for 15% off when you shop. Janai, thanks for joining me at the table today. I am so pumped that people get to meet you because you have been a friend for, we've been connected for a while now.
Yeah, a handful of months.
And when we first got together and started chatting, it was about, you know, this book that you were in conversations with the same publisher that I went through for my book, which was fun. Yeah. And I know you ended up signing and you just turned in your manuscript, at least at the point of recording this conversation. That's where you're at in the process. So I adore you, love following you. I'm so glad we're connected and I'm excited for everyone else to get to know you. So I thought it'd be fun to start with. I say this a lot because I got it from a church that I worked at years ago, but to know you is to know what?
Yeah, I think to know me is to know that, like, I love cheerleading people and being like a supporter of people and like almost to the point where I forget that I'm like a whole separate person. Like I really, really love being about like the big vision and helping someone else pursue like whatever they're doing, almost to the detriment of myself sometimes. But the book and this whole new like writing journey that I'm on is kind of one way to practice of like, how can I practice for myself what I usually do for other people. So I think like I really do just love people and love and curious about their stories and love learning about their stories and learning about how to support them. So
yeah, I love it because that's what we're all about here. Yeah. And also I have to laugh because when you first answered that and you said, I love cheerleading, before you continued that, I was like, you don't look at you and think you're a cheerleader. No. But I totally get what you mean. That's so funny. Oh my goodness. So curious what your upbringing was like, because we know that so much of who we become and who we are is the result, both in good ways and bad ways sometimes, of our upbringing. So I'd love to hear a little bit about yours if you're open to it.
Yeah. So I am a lifelong Texan. I live in Houston, Texas, and Houston's huge. So I've lived in the city center, but now I live in the suburbs, which is like almost a whole different like biosphere of people. It's very diverse, very different. But I grew up in a very small Texas town near the Texas-Louisiana border. And so I grew up biracial in the Texas South. And that is a very nuanced experience in Texas. I grew up as the daughter of a Filipina immigrant. My mom's Filipina. She immigrated. I don't know why she immigrated to Texas in the 80s, but that's where she landed. And my dad's a white man or was a white man. And so I'm a mixed kid that grew up in the Texas South. And I think like most people who are learning their own story and engaging their own stories today, I had a lot of like chaos in my childhood, not only from like the different racial dynamics of my family and in the cultural context that we were in, but also just a lot of like childhood trauma, a lot of hard things that you shouldn't have to see as a kid. And really the reason why I tend to cheerlead for other people and like love other people is because I really do want to do that for people. And also that was like a coping mechanism that I adapted into as a kid, because I realized this is how I need to behave so that I'm not abandoned, or that people don't forget to love me. It's like, I'm helpful for them. So it's kind of like there's like a shadow side and a sunshine side to like why I want to love people. But it's really the root of like a really hard childhood, and to the point where school was like a safe haven for me for a lot of the time. It was like a structured order to the chaos at home. And so, yes. And the chaos of culture. And so it was, it's hard to like categorize it. It's not the worst thing that like could ever happen to a kid, but like there was a lot of hard things that I'm probably only now engaging in my 30s of like, yeah, that really was hard. And that needs to be, and I'm only starting to validate those things now. So yeah, it was a hard childhood. And I think it gave me, for better or for worse, it shaped me into the person that I am today. A lot of resilience and a lot of compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful. And it so resonates. So I'm curious, I know you already mentioned being biracial, and maybe that's the answer to this, but I don't want to assume. I'm very curious. I want to know if there's a particular part of your identity, whether it's being a female or being biracial or whatever it may be, could be anything, that you haven't always embraced or been proud of, but you now take pride in.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say it's not that I embraced is a really good word. I would say it has a lot to do with like my ethnic makeup and my like racial makeup for sure. It's not so much that I didn't embrace my Filipina side. It's almost more so that like I actively erased it in order to adapt to and fit into the majority culture around me. So like, I actually looked it up because I was curious the other day at my hometown in like, you know, right next to the border of Louisiana and Texas, right by the coast. So like, we've like got hit by every hurricane imaginable, but, I looked up the census to look at like, what is the dynamic of the city? And it was like 70% white. I think it was 17% Latina and Hispanic, or Latino and Hispanic. And then like 4% Asian, 4% African-American, I think 3% mixed race. So like not a very ethnically diverse area. And so it's really not that I didn't embrace it. It's just, I really worked hard to actively erase it so that I would fit in more or so that I would be welcomed more. So yeah, now I take pride in it, but because it's funny because I'm Filipina, but I still struggle with understanding Filipino culture because I wasn't born in the Philippines. And I know the very Americanized version of the Philippines. So like what my mom kind of brought into the house, and I know when I hear a Filipino accent, like spoken by another family, I try to celebrate those things, but I also celebrate like, you know, whatever my mom, like the cultural understanding and what my mom brings to the table. And so embracing it now and understanding that it's just a part of like, it's a beautiful part of who I am, and that I get to bridge those cultures in a very specific and particular way. So I am proud of it. I am, I think it's a beautiful, the Filipino culture is really beautiful. I still feel like I'm learning more about it because it when you work so hard to kind of self-erase in order to fit in, and then you realize I'm not doing that anymore. It's hard to like reclaim the pieces of yourself that you kind of pressure washed away. Yeah. So, and yeah, being so far removed, I don't know how many thousands of miles away I'm removed from the Filipino island, like the islands themselves, it makes it harder to engage that. But I would say I'm definitely proud of my Filipino heritage and am willing and humble enough to like learn even more from other Filipino people I meet. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great answer. And, you know, you talk about, like you just said, you almost like actively tried to erase that part of yourself in an effort to feel included and welcomed. Yeah. You use a phrase a lot that I really hadn't heard before following you. And it's not like it's never been said before, probably, yeah. But you talk about othering. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like something that I've picked up in following you and your work is that you're very passionate about people not othering, mm-hmm. and systems and churches and you name it.
Yeah.
Not othering. Another way of saying that, tell me if this is synonymous, would be not excluding or not ostracizing, not marginalizing, not whatever.
Yeah.
So you've already said that it happened, but I'm curious if you could go back in time or could even be recent and tell me about a time that you have been othered, that you really experienced that othering.
Yeah, I think I can give you so many examples, but I think the example most people know me for and kind of what birthed my work that I do today and why I write today is being othered by the church that I was a part of. And not only a part of, we weren't merely like Easter and Christmas attendees. Like we were kind of in it, in the foundation of the thing. My husband and I helped plant the church. We were part of a big church planting movement that kind of came just before 2010. And we were all in for whatever was coming. And we were at that church for 11 years. And for the last 3 years of our time there, I was on staff. And so for those listening, they probably know the story. I've like told it in other places or kind of given slices and bits and pieces of the story in other places. But for the last 3 years, I was on staff. And it was like a dream to go on staff. 'Cause I think a lot of us really love when our worlds kind of collide and they integrate. So it's not like I have my work hat and my family hat and I've got to figure out the work-life balance. It was like, oh, I get to work with people who are like family. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited until I realized that working with people who are like family can be really messy, really chaotic, really convoluted when it's not done with humility and grace and care and love, when it's marked by insecurity. And so I came on to this staff and I, unbeknownst to me, I did not realize how difficult it could be. And slowly but surely, like the facade and the veneer of like this perfect dynamic just slowly cracked and crumbled away. And I realized it was just chaos all the time. And for whatever reason, and I think there are a few reasons, one of them being that I was a very administrative go-getter. And so I tended to get things done. But when you get things done, you're often handed a lot. And then it doesn't stop. And whenever when the body of Christ has become a machine that depends on your output and your productivity, you become less human and more like a cog in the machine. And at some point, like I was the cheerleader, I want to see this thing through. I want to get it done until it started breaking me. And I, at some point, started finding my voice and started speaking up for myself, probably in ways that I'd never practiced speaking up for myself before. And it was ultimately that kind of got me booted. And because I was challenging the system and how the system is breaking people, people were too dependent on the cultural system that they had created. And instead of changing the system, it was easier to make me the problem and get rid of me so that the system could stay the same. And so I think that was for a variety of reasons. I think that was because I was the most outspoken. I definitely believe I knew at the time, I was like, this has a lot to do with me being female and in a male-run church. And then it wasn't till later, like I had so actively like erased my ethnic identity at that point. Like I would just assume that I was white. I had a coworker who was kind of in the trenches with me at the time. She said, I know that you really do see like the disparity in like gender differences and how like that played a role in what happened to you. But she said, I also don't want to diminish the fact that you were the only minority member of our staff and you were the only person speaking out and you got booted. And mm-hmm. so I want to be sensitive to that as well. And it wasn't until, and this is a white coworker friend telling me this, and it wasn't until she gave me permission, I realized, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. Like the othering was more than just speaking out, more than just being a woman. It was so multi-layered. It like touched so many areas of my identity. And so that is the instance of othering that most people know me for, because that's mm-hmm. usually like the pain and the wound from which the healed wound that I speak from. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was kind of with that kind of rupture of faith, if you will, it kind of brought to light all these other instances in the past of like, why did this hurt so bad? Oh, this hurts so bad because it touches on so much of like the history of the life that I've lived, on instances where other people did that to me and I just didn't say anything, or I just kind of took it, and how like this is a story that I don't want to live anymore. Like I'm not going to live this story anymore, and I'm not going to let myself be subject to that again. So mm-hmm. I'm very passionate about not othering people, because it's happened to me so often. It never feels good.
Yeah.
It feels like you're less human when it happens. Yeah. And it's awful.
We'll get back to the conversation after this quick advertisement. I want to tell you about something Ian and I are using to uphold our boundaries in our home that's benefiting our marriage and ensuring that Shia doesn't always see us with our phones in hand. It's called Aro. Aro is a solution for aligning your actions and your intentions. What I mean by that is it's easy to want a life where you spend quality time face to face with your spouse, kids, friends, every single day. But are we willing to do whatever it takes to make that happen? I know I've tried a lot of different techniques and set goals around being unplugged and detached from my phone in order to be fully present, but Aro has been the most effective by far. Here's why. Aro is one part app, one part beautiful box. The Aro app tracks the time that your phone is put away in the box. And the box, which is aesthetically pleasing, by the way, sits on our bar cart in an area of our living room that we spend the most time in. It's a visual cue to put our phones away, an invitation to be intentional. Ian and I will often put our phones in it, forget that they're in there. Later, when we go back to get our phone out, it tells us how much time they were in the box and allows us to actually save, or in other words, log that time as whatever we were doing. So a few recent examples from the last week for me were baking, playing trucks with Shia, park as a family, dinner prep, reading. This is so motivating for me. Aro is a true invitation to do more of the things that we all say matter to us. And I'm telling you, it will change your life. Check out Aro at goaro.com. Use code MANDA to get 1 month free when you purchase an annual or 2-year membership. Now, back to the show.
Would you be willing to provide, like, I don't know, a couple more examples of how we may other people or be participating in systems that other people?
Yeah.
Because I think we hear this, or we're sitting in this conversation, even I'm like, you know, wanting to assume that I don't do this. Mm-hmm. I'm not involved in this, but yeah, whether intentionally or unintentionally, what are some other examples of how you've seen this play out?
Well, and this kind of touches on something that I just posted on Instagram today, but normally it is so common. I think when people talk about being othered or marginalized or experiencing racism in any sort of way, like they're looking for the obviously evil person that's committing like these overt acts of racism and just saying incendiary things off the wall all the time. And for the most part, we don't experience those people very often, because If we did in real life, like those people wouldn't have any friends. Like they would quickly self-correct their behavior and not do that anymore. And so often it's not very overt. It's very kind of covert and kind of under the mask or facade. And so Sorry, my printer is making noise. But what we usually experience is someone who, and we don't even know we're doing it because normally for a few reasons, but kind of what I find at the root of othering is just deep, deep insecurity. Like because I'm so deeply insecure about being the type of person I am, I have to make someone else or someone's else less than so that I seem more human. Mm-hmm. And there's actually this term called, it's two terms, in-grouping and out-grouping. I don't know if you've ever heard that in group dynamics.
No, I haven't.
It's kind of like it's a term for like social categorization, which isn't inherently wrong. It's kind of like, you know, with kids, you give them like a block and they put the square block in the square hole. They put the star block in the star hole, triangle block in the triangle hole. It helps in-grouping and out-grouping helps us understand who belongs where so that I know how I can move through this particular environment. Like I can kind of sense whether or not I belong. And if I belong, then they are my in-group. And if I don't belong, then I understand that I'm not in the in-group, I'm in the out-group. That's totally just like morally neutral. It becomes damaging when we start using our in-group against the out-group. Like we are more human as an in-group because we believe certain things or because we look a certain way or because we chant for a team that we all like. It can be like the in-groups can change based on like the context, the cultural context. And we feel go ahead.
Oh, no. Sorry. Keep going. But I had a thought.
We feel really good about our in-group because it's like a sense of camaraderie. Like we're in this, we want to win, but it's that like conquering mentality that's like at the root of how we engage in society that like encourages us to conquer the out-group, to make them less than, to tear them down. It's so directly tied to our security as in who we are as people, or like our lack thereof, or our self-esteem. So a lot of times people seek higher self-esteem through their group identity. And when you have low self-esteem, the quickest way to boost that is to tear someone else down who's different than you.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that I like the way you're describing this. I like the grouping description you gave, because as you were saying that, what came to mind is whether you want to take this like political or not, but the left and the right both does this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's not like no one's exempt. It's kind of like when my husband and I might be going on a tangent, but this is the connection I'm making in my brain. Okay.
Do it. Yeah.
It's kind of like when my husband and I were looking for a church when we moved to LA, it was really important to us that we found a church that was affirming of the LGBTQ community, that had women in leadership, that, you know, XYZ, we had these sort of things we were looking for. I won't call them like stipulations, but sort of non-negotiables of like, before we commit and like really plug into a church, these are some things that are really important to us.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first churches we went to, something we really, really liked about it was very clear when we walked in, visibly we could see it, and it was just felt, it was kind of in the culture, that it was a very inclusive place. Loved that.
Yeah.
My fear was that it was so far left, inclusive, progressive, probably left politically. In fact, there was quite a few things that alluded to that. My fear was that can people, friends and family of ours, when they visit, come to church with us on a Sunday, and are they going to feel like they're bad or they're not welcome? Because that swings too far for me. Like I'm always looking for, I always say this, this is like why this podcast exists. Like I don't believe in the black versus the white. Like I want to find the gray. I think there's room for a gray area here. And anyways, I want to hear you talk more than me talk. So I'll wrap this up by just saying that I loved that the pastor got up there, and one of the first things he said was, he said, largely this church leans this way, votes this way, believes these things. And that's great and wonderful and whatever. I don't know exactly how he said it, but he was like, but I just want to make it clear that you're no better than the person who voted this way, yeah. the person who believes this, that there are really good people who voted for the candidate you can't stand. There are really yeah. good people who don't believe that being gay, or that do believe being gay is a sin. They're still yeah. good people. Like, he kind of spoke to kind of the other side of this. Yeah. And I just remember being so grateful for that, because again, we are in such a polarizing world, and I'm seeing, like, it almost feels like one group saw a lot of people being othered, but their response to that othering is now has gone sometimes so far to where they're doing the same thing the yeah. other direction.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. It's really dogmatic. It's almost like a, when we normally talk about fundamentalism or like Christian fundamentalism, we think it's like, it looks a specific way, but it's just as bad. Like, there's actually a reverse fundamentalism too, where it's like, well, these are the new sets of standards that you have to meet. If you don't meet them, then you don't meet the fundamentals and you're out. And we use it as like a litmus test for whether or not you belong. And I think it's just as wrong, and it's just as harmful. It's just as wall building as it is for the other side. And so as long as I like in-group and out-group, those are just ways of saying us versus them. Yep. And it becomes really unhelpful when you keep saying them, when if you can never see them as a part of us, like as humanity, as our in-group, then we will never be able to build bridges between cultural divides, or even be curious. Like, we will inhibit our growth as humanity if we can't engage people who are different than us. If we are totally in echo chambers that are with just people who look and think and act like us, we won't move forward as a society if we don't allow for differences. So yeah, I really appreciate a pastor who can hold like the nuances of.
Right.
Yeah. Because I also have to understand that like my journey of becoming whoever I'm becoming is totally different from this other person. And there's gotta be space for that. If I believe in agency and choice and voice for every person, then I can't like suppress that, like oppress that other person with my own set of ideals and take their voice and their choice away. Like, that's not helpful.
Right.
And then I actually undermine my own message that says we all have agency. And then if I actually engage in ways that like take it away from someone, it's incongruent and out of alignment with like the sort of person I want to become.
Totally. Yeah. I've got sort of three questions for you
mm-hmm.
as we're processing this, kind of wrestling with it. And I know a lot of my listeners, I try really hard not to make this an echo chamber, but I do know that most of the people who listen to a Longer Table podcast are people who really want to see longer tables, not higher fences. They really want to see them become us. So yeah. to your point. So these three questions are really, I think, going to help us get there on an individual level, hopefully.
Yeah.
So I guess I want to start with how you define marginalized, which is typically the group we're talking about when we think of who's being othered.
Yeah. Well, it's defined by, there's a general definition, and then there are like cultural definitions and contextual definitions. So generally, I like to think of it as like, we are all collectively living the story of humanity. We are all collectively living our own individual stories, but we are also a part of a great story that's moving toward something. I believe we're moving toward the like new heaven and the new earth, and like where everything will be made right and no one will be crying anymore. So I actually think we are all a part of the larger story. And the way that I define marginalization is when the majority culture within a particular cultural context or a city or a state, or, and it changes and it morphs. But when the majority culture says, this is the story that we will affirm, this is the center of the story, this is how you have to conform or be malformed as a person to fit into this story that we're living, this is the story that we approve. And we say, you have to live it. That's when we actively marginalize someone who can't or won't or should be free to live different stories. So we push their stories to the margins. And normally who that happens to, I actually, there's like kind of a list. I learned this list from a course that I'm taking right now, and it's a great list. And it covers, this isn't, this is a generalization. There are probably other ways, but this is generally, people are normal in the way that we normally talk about marginalization in the States, especially is race and ethnicity are top ones. Gender is another way that people can be marginalized, or gender identity, sexual orientation, education level. Some people don't like think about education level a lot, but it's real. Income, your address, whether or not you live on the right or the wrong side of the tracks, you can be marginalized for your religious beliefs or lack thereof, or whether they're not the right religious beliefs according to the majority. Your physical health or physical ability, like if you were in a wheelchair or if you have a chronic illness. Age is another one. Ageism is huge. And mental health, mental ability, whether someone has, whether someone is neurotypical, meaning their brain and how society works, is operating in such a way that it was made for their brain, they're neurotypical, or they're neurodivergent. Like society actually isn't built for the ways that their brain. And those are people with like certain different diagnoses. But there's so many ways that people can't, that we all carry marginalized identities within us. Even those who are at the top of the power pyramid, like they carry, like there are wounds within them where they were marginalized. And more often than not, because of their insecurity, they learned what they needed to do to cope and make up for what lacked within them, so that they wouldn't be marginalized again. It's just that some people are better able to kind of work the system, whereas other people are just less able to work the system because it was not built with them in mind. And so, yeah. Race and ethnicity usually play, that's the usually most hot button topic. Sexual orientation is another one, but it's not always just, and I'm saying this to you as a woman of color speaking to a white woman, it's not always white people against people of color. It can be it's so much more multi-layered than that, whether or not you have a handicapped parking spot available to you at a local restaurant or church, or it's you just realize society is built for some people in more ways than others. And subconsciously we move, when you have more privilege, you move through the world not even thinking about how other people struggle.
Yeah. So that leads perfectly into the next question, which I was going to ask, which is how can we be better stewards of our privilege and our influence? How can we stop othering when we see it happening? How can we participate less? What would you even say is the opposite of othering?
Yeah.
Including, uplifting. I don't even know,
Hospitality, welcoming, humility is a huge one. Whenever I hear the words privilege and influence, I think those are just kind of subheadings for power. Like these are the different ways that I have power within my specific context. And this is what privilege looks like for my specific context. And I think what we do with our power matters. Like normally when we hear about power in conversations, it's bad. It's like someone's abused or misused power. But if you read the first two chapters of Genesis, like there was actually a lot of good power that was used to kind of bring forth the rest of creation. And I think about artists who have a good power when they craft together words and send out beautiful words out into the world. So some power is good. It's a matter of using your privilege and your influence to lift others up, rather than punch down.
Yep.
And I think I can't go out and exercise influence in all the ways that other people can. But I know that, like, even on like Instagram, I have some people who listen to my words. It just means that I'm much more mindful about the ways in which I use my words. If I can't, I've got to be committed to not othering the other side, even whenever I'm calling out abuse in the pulpit or, you know, awful behaviors through news stories, reports that we learn about happening within the church. I have to be careful not to dehumanize them to make me seem more human. It's about having empathy and understanding, like, they forgot who they were. And that it was because they forgot who they were that caused them to hurt other people. So I cannot forget who I am. I think part of it is stewarding your power and your privilege and your influence is finding, like, how can I ground myself and make myself secure in such a way that I don't act and react out of a place of insecurity where I intentionally or unintentionally lash out at other people or tear them down or make them less than so that I feel better about myself. And it's so tempting. It's so tempting because it's so easy to do. And with the nature of like social media and like Twitter, even like it's really, the system almost encourages you to do that. And you, if you do that, you'll get a lot of likes. You'll be so much more popular.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that answer. And I think that is the thing I've had to resist the most is what you're describing. Knowing that if I take really strong stances and I'm super outspoken and I other who the people who I think are wrong, that gets a lot of attention. And sometimes it's easy for me to kind of go there because of passion. So naturally, and also just my wiring as an Enneagram 8.
Yeah.
But I really, really, really believe that it's just as harmful as the very thing that I'm upset at them for.
Yeah.
That in its own way, it's just as harmful. And it's just another form of othering. Yeah. Okay. So my last question is a fun one, which is, what is the book called? When is it coming out? Tell us anything you're allowed or want to share so that we can look forward to it.
Yeah. I've kept the title pretty close because part of me is like, are they going to let me keep this title? I think they are. If they
is it
don't,
publishing wild like that?
I know. I'm like, please let me just keep my words. Like, I really want to keep these words. But I know Steph likes my editor, Steph loves this. And she was like, I think that's your title. So I'm like really hopeful.
And she was on the podcast. So people regularly know her. Yeah.
So what I'm hoping we run with for the book title is Blessed Are the Othered. So it's essentially kind of playing off the Beatitudes, like, you know, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. If you kind of go through the Beatitudes, and I go through this in the book, like essentially every single group that Jesus is blessing in the Beatitudes is being othered or has been othered in some way for mourning, for, you know, being persecuted. And I kind of walk through the book, through the stories of scripture in the ways that like God has actively pursued the othered. He seeks them out. He doesn't cast them out. He seeks them out. He goes to them. He goes to Hagar in the wilderness and like asks her, you know, what do you need? Where are you running from? Like he invites her to like tell her story. And so often like the othered and the marginalized are not invited to tell their story. Like they usually sit on the margins. They go unnamed, they're quiet. And so I go through the book with essentially how God has consistently met people where they are, people with the least amount of power, who are the most vulnerable, and ultimately how like Jesus himself was othered. He was abused, battered, and bruised by people in power because they othered him for not conforming to what they deemed the acceptable standard. And so, yeah, I am really, really looking forward. It's really a vulnerable thing to try to like write a book because you're like, man, this is, is this going to land? It's in my brain and I'm hoping that it's coming out onto the page really well. But I think like I think the meat of it is there, and I'm just really excited to kind of finesse it a bit more and put it into shape so that we can put it into people's hands sometime next year.
Yay. Yeah. Well, I can't wait. I'm super excited to read it, and we'll be sure to put it out there and link it when it's at that stage and it's ready. But in the meantime, it's great that you're not withholding the words that you have inside of you, and you're putting it out there, and you're preaching that message and like advocating for change. And so I think it's really great. I've loved this. I think it's been super helpful. So we'll be sure to link you in the show notes so that people know how to follow along and find your work on Instagram and Substack and all the places.
Yeah, all the places. I'm there.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Amanda.